Well, it's starting to get very busy, and that means that there's lots of news. We just wish somebody would report it accurately. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Great to be back with you, Barry. Well, I shouldn't necessarily say great. We're recording this on Thursday, and I just got back last night from 4 days in Orlando, Florida. My sister has a condo down there, and she invited me to come down, meet her. Actually, I drove down with her, and we met my mom, whose 84th birthday was February 7th, down there, and we had a great time. And let me tell you something. It was in the 80s every day, so time was spent at the pool. Time was spent sitting out on the veranda in the sunny weather, and every day it was at 83. In fact, one night it got cool enough that I had to put on a slip over, you know, a little sweatshirt, because it got down to the end of the 60s and it was, you know, I got a little uncomfortable. I get back here last night, by the way, an hour late because of plane issues in Orlando. And they did a good job. I'd much rather have the plane maintained before I fly on it than have the pieces picked up when I land. So we were happy to get that done. But I get here, and what do I get? The first thing I see when I get in the car, snow flurries. And by the time I get back to Newark, we're getting that little fine pellety snow, if you know what I mean, that nasty little pellety stuff.
Yes.
That makes tinking noises when it hits your porch. And I didn't care for that. So just so you know that, I'm mad at Ohio for giving me bad weather when I got back. But apparently they're going to try to make it up to me this weekend, which I will accept. I'll accept their apology.
Well, you know, that's good. And, you know, I just hope that you don't rub it in because... And actually, you can't, because really, when it got right down to it, while you were sitting there in the 80s, we were kind of going through all kinds of stuff. And up until a couple, 3 days ago, I mean, I had the heat turned off in our house. You know, temperatures were sitting down here in the upper 60s during the day, and that's pretty comfortable.
Yeah, I'd take that.
But I can understand having to acclimatize back from 80s to 30s. Yeah, that would be tough.
Yeah,
that'd be tough.
It was definitely not fun. But, we're glad to be home. That's all I can say. It's, you know, back to the business routine. And the fact is that, yes, as much as it's nice to lay around for a few days, after a while you sort of get itchy to do something. I guess this is why some people don't do well in retirement. The ones that do well basically go find something else to do. They volunteer someplace. They do some kind of work, or they open a small business and do little things. My mom, who's 84... Believe it or not, is still a manager for an apartment complex. It's her job to get the apartments clean and to collect the rent.
Well, Chuck, you know that I remember you said, you know, you had very little to do while you were stuck in the lovely warm climes of Florida. But I remember, you know, when you and I were traveling quite a bit for various boards and things that we sat on, and we had to go to national meetings, places like Salt Lake and Tampa and other, I can't remember how many other places we went to.
Lots of places.
Lots of places, yeah. And we could always find, we were never bored, because, well, other than the excitement that was going on in the meetings, and let me tell you, folks, sometimes that was pretty exciting.
Yes.
Yeah, maybe more so than we would have liked.
Yeah, exactly.
But when we had downtime, we never got bored, because there was this little thing called bookstores that were the key attraction for us in pulling out. You know, most people go in and try to find really nice restaurants or really some unique and out of the way kind of touristy things. Nope. Let's Google up bookstores.
Well, yeah. And unfortunately, in Orlando, one thing I've discovered since I've been down there, there aren't that many very good used bookstores. People don't read down there, or what. Yeah, you can always find the little joints that do the paperback exchanges. And sometimes you can find something interesting in there. Usually, you know, science fiction or something that you know. I'm not a big fiction reader. I am a history reader and always have been. One thing you find about those little paperback places is it's people coming in to exchange romances. Okay.
Oh, yes.
Romance novels. Look, romance novels, I have relatives who read the things, and every once in a while, if you're just absolutely bored stiff and there's nothing going on, you pick one up and thumb it. Well, what I've discovered is that A, they're boring as anything. B, they're exactly the same book over and over and over.
It's all the same story.
They change the time frame. You know, it's a different year. It's a different period of history. The names are a little different. The stuff that goes on is exactly the same thing. So, you know, please save me from that. If you remember the old show Star Trek: The Next Generation, there was one with a fantasy land. It was this planet, but they found one place that could sustain life, so they beamed down to there. And what they discovered was it was a casino, like from the 1940s or something. And apparently it was on a loop. It kept doing the same thing over and over and over again. And what they discovered was they found in one of the bedrooms an astronaut from Earth who at that point had been dead for hundreds of years. But apparently they'd set this up because somebody found a book on the spaceship that had this scenario in it. So they thought that was what life was like on Earth. So they set this up for this guy who'd apparently gotten lost. And meanwhile, he'd apparently been bored to death. Because it was the same book he was reliving over and over and over and over and over again. Well, that would drive anybody nuts. But that being the case, I'm a history reader, and I'm a history reader because history is so much more interesting than fiction could ever hope to be. People are way more eccentric. The things that they get involved with are way more odd and strange and interesting than anything that can be come up with in a novelization. Because if you read it in a novelization, if you read it in a work of fiction, you're like, that'd never happen. Especially not the way it usually does happen in fiction. When you read history, and it's well-documented history, well, that seems to be pretty much the way that it did happen. So once you get involved in reading history and reading about individuals who are way more interesting and way more eccentric and way more alive than a sort of even a good fiction writer can do. I've read some fiction like, for instance, I read 1984. And I think the author was excellent at painting what he wanted to paint, because I can remember reading 1984. George Orwell. And getting the picture, and I could see the stuff. I could see the things happening in my head, but I could only see it in black and white, in shades of gray. So, in other words, it was dismal. Well, that book's dismal. If you've ever read, ladies and gentlemen, you should read 1984 if you want to understand the totalitarian mindset. But if you read it, it's a dismal book. And it's unique. It's a very unique book. And of course, someone has decided that Trump is Orwellian, so 1984 is selling once again. Good. Read it. Because you find out that Trump has nothing to do with 1984, although the last president probably did.
Uh-huh.
And with the revolt of the intelligence services during the early part of Trump's presidency, some of that may show up a little bit in 1984 as well. Although you'd do better to read Animal Farm for that. If you've ever read Orwell's Animal Farm, that's a little bit more in there. But that being said, that's why I read history. And so we always tried to find bookstores that had good history and government sections. And
that's true. You know, it's funny you brought up Orwell. Because you're right, 1984 has experienced a resurge of interest because of the meme of alternative facts.
Yes.
That have been spun out there. And of course, if you're on the left, you're spinning it against the Trump administration. And if you're on the right, you're spinning it against the media. And I'm not so sure that either one of them are that far off from really the truth.
Well, okay. What was Winston Smith's job?
But I do know
job?
One thing is, I have benefited from it, Chuck. I, as you may know, my middle son has started an eBay business. Well, here not too long ago, we were browsing through, you know, a junk shop, i.e. flea market type place. Yeah. And I ran across this little book. And this little book happened to be 1984. But it also happened to be the first American edition of 1984.
That's pretty spectacular, yeah.
Which actually just sold online in our eBay store here about 2 weeks ago. So, needless to say, we were very happy with the fact that 1984 is experiencing a resurgence.
Well, let me ask you a question. What was Winston Smith's job in 1984, the protagonist? What was his job?
He was. Didn't he push things down the memory hole at the Ministry of Truth?
He worked in the Ministry of Information.
Information, that's right.
And he would cut out stories that were of people who had become non-persons and made reference to people who no longer existed. That means they'd been liquidated, and he put it down the memory hole. And the memory hole led to an incinerator in the basement. And so when you went to access that information, and what that was a reference to Joseph Stalin. And the fact that he would have people airbrushed out of photographs once they'd been liquidated as an enemy of the state and an enemy of Stalin, he would have them airbrushed out of photographs, and there it led to some strange results. Like, for instance, Joseph Stalin gripping the hand of a person who wasn't there, you know, who a tree stood in his spot or something, you know. And so it led to some very interesting things.
You know, if you think of it, and I've seen some of those photos, and yeah, it's fairly obvious things are airbrushed. But nowadays, we don't need to do that because we have Photoshop.
That's right. Although Photoshop,
so you can put anything you want to in there. You know, you could.
Yeah, strange things happen though with Photoshop too. People that don't do it well, or even some that do, you can usually tell it's been Photoshopped.
Well, and you know, Chuck, some of the reasons why we like history, and by that, you know, when we're talking about history. I know you and I both, we usually don't read much modern history. We read history that was written by historians and authors 50, 60, 80 years ago and, you know, look back through history. Now, some of the modern stuff, you have to pick and choose very carefully because there's an awful lot of bad writing out there.
Yeah, real bad.
And as a matter of fact, if you don't believe me, just go and look at most major news outlets today. And look at the absolute lack of any kind of journalistic standards or actual logical thought process, I think. And I think that you've got a good example of that, don't you?
Well, Barry, one of the things I did yesterday while I was sitting on the veranda soaking up the sun.
Yes.
It wasn't yesterday. It was the day before yesterday. A copy of USA Today, also known as McPaper, for obvious reasons, because it's junk food. Came to the condo. Okay, so we're sitting out on the veranda, and my sister, who's very politically savvy, read it to me, the opening paragraph of this thing, and said, "Do you understand what this said?" Well, I actually had to read it about three more times before I actually understood what I think the author was trying to say. Now, and I'll show you, I'm going to read it to you so you can discern for yourselves what the problem is. All right, here's the opening paragraph. More banks are tightening consumer credit standards, and more Americans are getting worried about defaulting on loans as lenders target less creditworthy borrowers to grow revenue and delinquencies edge higher, surveys show. Okay. Do you really understand what that author is trying to say?
Well, you know, you and I chatted about this offline, and I said, well, yeah, I think I get what he's trying to say. And then you went back and read the headline.
Yeah, it's tougher.
It was a totally different spin.
So. The headline is, it's tougher to get a credit card or a car loan.
Yeah.
Now, what this basically says is that lenders, in order to boost revenues, to grow revenue... Yes. Are targeting less creditworthy borrowers. In other words, they don't want to loan money to creditworthy borrowers. They want to loan money to non-creditworthy borrowers. Does that make any sense at all?
Only if you see that there's a federal program out there that bails them out at twice the rate if they, you know, if they end up with a bunch of garbage paper on their books because of turning out loans to people who don't have a good credit rating.
I'll be quite honest. It doesn't make any this is a contradictory article. Self-contradictory, as the first sentence and the last sentence show. More banks are tightening consumer credit standards. In other words, they're making it tougher to get a loan, and more Americans are getting worried about defaulting on loans. Okay, why are Americans worried about defaulting on loans if it's easy credit, as the last sentence shows? And again, defaulting on loans as lenders target less creditworthy borrowers to grow revenue and delinquencies edge higher. Okay, so we're tightening credit everywhere except with people who can afford and can pay back a loan.
Right, and you know what that smacks of, Chuck? That's the subprime mortgage crisis that created the big crash in 2008.
Exactly. Now, that's not the only problem in this article. I sent you a copy of the electronic copy of this article, which is, in fact, different. It's the same article. It has a different title. Loans are getting harder to come by for some consumers. Well, it's the same sentiment, but it's written by the same guy, and it's in the same edition of the paper, but this is the online edition. And here's what that same sentence says on the online edition. Banks are getting more picky about which consumers they're approving for loans as borrowers with spottier credit history struggle to keep up with the payments. Well, I hate to tell you this, but that opening paragraph makes sense.
Yeah, but the point is that it's completely 180 degrees opposite of what that opening paragraph in the print edition
says. That's exactly right. They don't say the same thing at all. But what really got me was the next paragraph. And the next paragraph says, the data is surprising in light of an economy and labor market that have been rolling along. Consumers are benefiting from solid job growth, faster pay increases, and low debt levels. And the stock market is at record highs. Okay, that's also nonsense. And one of the things that get me, low debt levels. If debt levels are so low, then why are consumers worried about defaulting on loans, as we saw in the first paragraph? Why would that be? Second of all, the job market is rolling along. The labor market has been rolling along. Barry, there are 96 million people out of work in the United States of America. 96 mm-hmm. million. Now, some of those people shouldn't be at work. They're retirees. They're people that are ill. There are people that are children. Those people shouldn't be working. The fact is that a huge number of that 96 million, and remember, the population of the United States is around 320 or 330 million people. That means approaching one in three does not have a job. That means that the one is living off the back of the three, or of the two. The one is living off the back of the two. And if those mm-hmm. numbers flip, that's when you've really gotten into a welfare state mess. And we're not far from that, because a lot of the two are on subsidized jobs. In other words, if government money wasn't there to subsidize their employment, they wouldn't be working. That being said, faster pay increases? When was the last time you had a pay increase?
I'm self-employed, so I don't get those kind of things.
And my wife and I were discussing this last night. I go, I haven't had a pay increase in years. There are other ways I can get around some of that, but we have to be creative. Consumers have solid job growth. Solid job growth. Okay, we already talked about that. There's a lot of jobs out there, and a lot of them are paying not necessarily a living wage, $9-$10 an hour. Yeah, there's a lot of people in those jobs, but you're not going to take big credit cards. I want to know why banks are giving $10,000 limit credit cards to kids who are just coming out of college with $100,000 in debt. Barry, the fact is we as a society are literally swimming in debt. And it's sort of like, does a fish know he's wet? These kids don't know they're wet. They don't know how bad it can be. Right. And we're giving them all the outs we can to have to not to pay back the loans that they've taken out. You know, my kids all paid for their own schooling, and they did so taking a minimum of student loans, an absolute drop-dead minimum. So they don't owe tens of thousands of dollars coming out of college. They owe a few thousand bucks, which they're paying off. There are other people that are coming out with $100,000, $250,000, $300,000 sometimes if you're coming out of professional school like a medical degree. Well, what are you going to do under Obamacare when doctors' incomes are restricted and they've got $300,000 in debt to pay off? They're going to default, or, you know,
of course.
Yeah, have to live in a trailer someplace. And don't kid yourself, that's not going to happen. But here's the next sentence. Now, get this one. 11.7% of banks tightened standards after giving us all this rigmarole nonsense about good job markets and low debt and all that stuff that was nonsense. Yet 11.7% of banks tightened standards for auto loans in the first quarter, up from 3.3% late last year and the highest level on records dating to 2011, according to the Senior Loan Officer Survey released by the Federal Reserve last week and Deutsche Bank. Okay, Deutsche Bank. Really, why Deutsche Bank? It's the Bank of Germany. What does that have to do with us? And why is the Federal Reserve? Why is the Federal Reserve involved in this kind of propaganda? Because this is nonsense. It's propaganda. It's drivel. Is Janet Yellen essentially trying to justify her statements that she is about to trash the economy? She hasn't said this, but she's going to trash the economy to make Trump look bad by incrementally raising the interest rate. Well, what happens when the interest rates go up? People quit buying stuff.
Yep.
So
that's usually what happens.
Now, let me ask you a question. Why would you print such utter nonsense as the data is surprising, you know, in light of an economy and labor market that have been rolling along? This is part of the meme, by the way, that Barack Obama left Donald Trump in charge of a booming economy. Well, the economy has not been booming since 2008, and essentially right up until just before the election, people were talking about how sluggish the recovery has been. I always love it. Everything that's not a recession is now a recovery, which it strikes me as progressivist language. But that being said, why would you print such utter nonsense that the economy is booming along and the job market is booming along when we know that a huge number of people aren't working and have stopped looking because there isn't anything out there for them that pays enough to actually do anything with, other than live in a trailer park someplace? Why would you print that?
Well, okay, let me key in on what's happening in the media these days. Chuck, the organ that you found this beautiful screed in was the USA Today, right?
Yes.
Which is a daily paper during the week.
They have to publish
5 days a week, right?
Not anymore. They only publish every other day.
Nice. Now you're getting it. See, the problem is that there's a lack of things going on newsworthy, Chuck?
No.
Or is it there is a lack of having people who are coming out of journalism schools and colleges who know how to construct a sentence, who know how to do research, or who can objectively write something without sticking their own personal opinions and feelings into it?
Well, if you look at the online, part of the, you know, some of this is in the online article and some of it isn't, which, what does that tell you? That the online article is vastly different than the one they put in print.
Yes.
That means somebody read the online article.
You also have the time issue as well, because many of the media organizations, and this is an actual hit on them, not a lauding, are realizing that print media is starting to Go the Way of the Dinosaur, and it's all about the online media. But what they've been saddled with is the fact that print media is still there and they're still using it, and it has hard deadlines because you have to put it together and you have to actually get the physical papers printed and get them on the trucks and planes and everywhere else they're going to drop, so that, you know, at 6:30 in the morning, if you're staying in a hotel that still does it, they can drop a fresh, crisp USA Today right outside your hotel room door, so you can read the morning news. Well, oftentimes that means that they're probably not doing a very good job of editing the articles that are coming in because of those time deadlines, which is, you know, I'm not giving them any praise for that. It's all criticism. Then they realize that they've got themselves a hot mess, which is what you're talking about right there. And they are stuck unless they're putting it online. And then if they're putting it online, they can edit it and change it. And you and I have seen that before, too, where headlines change. And even sometimes half the article changes, because from the time that they put it into the print edition to the time they posted it online, somebody somewhere in the organization actually took the time and to do their job and read it over and say, wait a minute, this isn't working right. Yeah, what is this garbage? I feel for editors at newspapers. I really do, Chuck, because they have got a very, very hard job these days.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, one thing you'll find with honest, or shall I say more honest, I don't want to make absolute statements because most of these places aren't honest. More honest newspapers and online publications that also do print publications will say at the bottom of our article, this article differs from the print version due to editorial, editorial work and that kind of thing. But let me ask you a question, Barry. How solid? I understand they have a hard deadline to get stuff into print, but think about this: if you've got an extra day in between editions, why would you have to jump through this hoop? In other words, you got an extra day to finish your article and get it through the editorial process. I'll be quite honest. Somebody in upper management read it and said, what are you trying to say here? After it was published, somebody looked at it and said, okay, this story doesn't mean anything. Now, the story goes on to say things like, 11.7% of banks tightened standards for auto loans in the first quarter, up from 3.3% late last year and the highest level on records dating to 2011, according to the senior loan officer at Deutsche Bank. Okay, Deutsche Bank. Who goes to Deutsche Bank in the United States of America to take a car loan? I'm pretty sure.
Well, obviously people who can't get a car loan at one of the other regular
one
banks.
One of the American banks. Yeah, they go overseas to get a car loan. That sounds funky to me. Why, Deutsche Bank. If you don't know, folks, that's the Bank of Germany.
Right, it is.
And credit card standards were toughened by 8.3% of banks. Folks, let me tell you something. I'm tired of paying 23% interest because somebody else can't pay their credit card loans. Why are people getting out of college and getting credit card offers with $10,000 limits when they already owe $100,000 in student loan debt? This makes no sense to me whatsoever. We're basically we've got people who are so used to debt. It's like does a fish know he's wet? Does a college student know he's in debt? No. In fact, they're sitting around waiting for somebody to come along, a Bernie Sanders to come along and say that their education should be free. Well, there is no free ride. I have a relative who posted something on Facebook recently about applauding the fact that somebody in Tennessee, the governor came out and said he wanted to make all community colleges free. And I said, all I reply, you know, I've learned to do this. I said, okay, wow, who's going to pay the bill? And the reply I got back was, well, I don't know. And then I got back a thing that talked about the guy who runs the Flying J, the company who does the Flying J. He was given some money, and I said, what happens when that money runs out? Who gets stuck with the bill when the money runs out? Barry, you and I know from our lengthy experience who gets stuck with the bill. Suddenly the taxpayers are paying for kids to go to community college. You know what? My kids paid for most of their educations themselves with their own money and took very few student loans. They took some, but they took very small ones. And you know what? They value their education far more than people I know who got it all handed to them. Why is that? They earned theirs. The mm-hmm. other people were given it as a gift, and therefore it's just simply not that important to them. It's the lesson that we learned with housing projects. When you give people $25 a month rent, they're not going to take care of the property. When you charge people a large rent, they tend to be more careful because it has value to them. If they're going to pay $1,000 a month to live in an apartment, they want a nice place. They therefore don't trash it. They don't set it on fire. They don't paint it odd colors. Some people do, but you know, that's a taste thing. But they don't work to destroy the property. You know, they don't haul in junk and set it in the yard. That's what the USA Today here is doing, is essentially trying to set up a meme of economic failure in the Trump administration. Folks, mm-hmm. Donald Trump's first budget will not take effect until next October. So blaming him for any downturns at this point, first of all, how much say does the president have in these policies? Well, he has some because, you know, the Federal Reserve System and all that stuff. You know, he can control the Fed through the once every 7 year appointment of the head of the Federal Reserve System. But without getting into too much detail on that, basically, the Federal Reserve System is a private corporation. It always has been. The directors come from a list that the owner banks, the stockholding banks, basically submit. Let's not kid ourselves. But Janet Yellen, who's the current Fed chair, is basically being transparent that she's going to do her best to drive the economy into the dirt so that Donald Trump gets the blame for it. Now, she's not saying it directly, but she's already. But what they're doing is they're talking about, we got to incrementally raise interest rates to stop this overheating economy. I'm laughing. Where is all this money in this overheated economy? There is no overheated economy.
It's in somebody else's pocket.
Well, yeah, somebody other than mine. Yeah. But that being said, this is what we're going through with the fake news cycle that we're going through. You know, the news media tried to make a big thing about fake news and how it killed Hillary. No, what killed Hillary was the fact that she was a lousy candidate.
And, yeah, that's true.
And the absolutely fact that people true. Were absolutely dead angry at Barack Obama.
Yeah. But you know what, Chuck? I'm glad you said all that, because I'm sitting here and I caught an article from the Washington Post, and I think it fits our theme here today because it ties in all this stuff, bad journalism and axes to grind and the Hillary Clinton loss, because the Washington Post has pretty much put out there now an analysis where they think they've nailed the crux of the problem, Chuck. And their headline reads, "Do voter identification laws suppress minority voting?" And yes, we did the research, unquote. Now, you know, when it's such a definitive statement in the banner headline that the article had better show the proof, right?
Yep.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, they start off with basically attacking Jeff Sessions because, you know, he's, you know, hardcore right winger. He's bigot, blah, 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 blah. They don't actually say all that, but they bring the leadership conference on civil and human rights, being concerned about his, quote, record of hostility toward the Voting Rights Act. And then if you keep reading down into the paragraph, at the very bottom here, in the last sentence in the paragraph says, no one knows for sure how Sessions will perform as Attorney General. The reform or Republican senator from Alabama did, after all, once vote to renew the Voting Rights Act in 2006. But for many, his record is deeply troubling. So here they start off saying he's got a record of hostility towards the Voting Rights Act, but then they have to admit at the end of the paragraph, well, he did vote to renew it.
The record that's deeply troubling, could you be more specific? And the answer is no, they're not going to get
more
specific.
No, because they have an axe to grind and they're setting up their meme. And basically they say, well, we don't know all that. You know, we don't know how he's going to perform as Attorney General, but we do know that voter identification laws are spreading around the country. Well, I wonder why, Chuck. I mean, with the number of illegal immigrants we have in the country, states are being smart in protecting their ballot procedures. And so they're moaning about this, and they say, as we detail below, our research shows that these laws lower minority turnout and benefit the Republican Party. Wow. Okay. Now, you keep reading down into the article, okay, if you can stomach it. and they get to there, how we did our research. And so first and foremost, they have data. Now, first of all, what they say, and I like it. They pre-set it up. You know, they said there's widespread debate about the merits of these laws, blah, 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 blah. Scholars have been able to show that racial and ethnic minorities have less access to photo IDs. And extensive analysis reveals almost no evidence of voter fraud.
Extensive analysis. How do you analyze something for which you're not gathering data?
Yeah, if there's no evidence, then how can you analyze it? That was my first thought. And then they keep going here and says the key question is not whether there could be effects from these laws, but whether shifts in electoral participation and outcomes have actually occurred. Okay, so that's their setup here. And, of course, then they qualify that, too, by doubling down, saying because these laws are new, it's been almost impossible to assess their consequences. But God bless us, the Washington Post is on the job, and they were able to do it because they're smarter than everybody else. They have data from the nation's most recent elections, and so does everybody else, and can single out and test the effect of strict voter ID laws in multiple elections in multiple states. Well, okay, yeah, so can everybody else. We have validated voting data, so we know that whether each of our respondents actually voted, and so does everybody else. And we have a huge sample from the Cooperative Congressional Election Study. Now, Chuck.
Hold on. Cooperative Congressional Election Study. Who right. conducted this study? How was it done?
Well, I'm assuming since it has the word congressional, that maybe the Congress did this study.
Wrong.
But we don't know that because I don't know about the cooperative thing. And they don't explain what that is, but they put it out there as this is the new and improved or super deluxe thing that makes them so special. We can analyze the partition of racial and ethnic minorities in all states, both before and after strict ID laws are implemented. Okay, well, that's wonderful. Then, of course, if you haven't gone mind numb by the time you get to this point, then you start seeing the cracks in the facade. When we compare overall turnout in states with strict ID laws to turnout in states without these laws, we find no significant difference. Pattern matches with most existing studies, but when we dig deeper and look specifically at racial and ethnic minority turnout, we see a significant drop in minority participation. And they keep going through here, and they talk about how Hispanics are affected the most. Turnout is 7.1 percentage points lower in general elections and 5.3 points lower in primaries in strict ID states than it is in other states. Okay, what are they not saying here, Chuck?
How many of those are illegal?
Well, that's one thing, but there's an awful lot more they're not saying. Number one, are they comparing apples to apples?
Well, no, of course they're not, because that would destroy their what they're trying to say.
Right, because the only way you can compare apples to apples in a state-by-state study is doing what?
by studying comparable districts, voting regions.
And the point is, you have to pick only the presidential race because it's the only one on every state's ballot that's the same in the general election.
Yeah, that's true. Listen, yes.
But they're not doing that because if you go back up and you read carefully, they said that they've got voting data from 2006 to 2014.
Okay. Eight years, yeah.
How many presidential elections happened in 2006?
Zero.
How many happened in 2014?
Zero.
Exactly. So, in other words, the band of the elections they're working with would basically be the 8, the 12, and that's it.
That's it.
So there'd only be two presidential elections. And if that's the case, then who was the...
Barack Obama.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, let's keep going now. Keep that in mind. And it says strict ID laws mean lower African American, Asian American, and multiracial American turnout. White turnout is largely unaffected. And it has a disproportionate effect on it. And they have these beautiful graphs here about the racial gap between whites and turnout and non-white turnout in these, both in general and primary elections. And I think it's incredible, Chuck, because do you realize that in primary elections, there's a gap of 18.8% in the turnout in states with strict voter ID for Asian Americans. Now, you keep reading, you think about it because it looks, you know, that's the beautiful part about using graphs and bar graphs and charts, is it's the thing to people can draw their attention to and give them the sense of what you want them to think without them having to invest in actually reading and thinking through what you're actually saying. But you get right down here keep going and talking, and they're like, you know, the primary elections, it's more dramatic. The turnout gap between whites and blacks grows significantly when a state adds strict ID laws. And they keep going and talk about here, but then they did this, the one thing that I hilariously, I just couldn't believe that they actually put in print, and that somebody didn't stop them on. Their little sub headline says, when a state has strict voter ID laws, those who do vote are more conservative. And of course, here's how they back that up, Chuck. All of this has real political consequences because minority voters tend to be Democrats. Strict voter ID laws tilt the primary electorate dramatically. Now, let that sink in for you just a minute. What is a primary election?
Well, it's where you essentially, for the most part, go to pick the candidate that's going to run, who's going to be the nominee to run under a specific party banner for a specific office.
Yes, exactly. A specific party banner. A primary election is all about the parties doing their own housekeeping, right?
Yes.
So who votes in those primaries?
The party faithful, usually. Joe Blow doesn't show up to vote in a primary election if he doesn't care about who's the final candidate.
Yeah, but you remember the Post doubled down on stupid in their headlines, the fact that these states with strict ID laws affect minorities disparately. And their key evidence, Chuck, is the fact that if you have strict voter ID, you're going to have fewer minorities turning out in primaries. Now, why in the world would that tilt a primary election dramatically when they've admitted previously in this article that the vast majority of these ethnic minorities vote for what party?
Well, look, with identity politics being so rampant as it is right now, ethnic minorities tend to vote democratically.
Exactly. And they state this. It says, because minority voters tend to be Democrats, strict voter ID. So tell me, how in the world does a strict voter ID law hurt an intra-party vote in a primary. So not enough are coming out to vote for, you know, Villaraigosa for mayor, or, and they don't have strict voter ID laws in California.
Not hardly.
But the point is that, Chuck, they're trying to make a case based upon something that, if you just use pure logic, it's like, it doesn't matter. If your folks are not turning out to come to primaries, maybe it's because you don't have any good candidates for them.
Well, or there's nothing exciting about it. You know, it's Joe Schmuckatelli versus Marvin Foonman, and everybody's sort of like, you know, the nuances in their position are so minor that they're sort of like, I don't care. Whichever one gets on the ballot, that's the guy I'll vote for in November.
Yeah, so they get down to this whole like deep dive analysis of data to come up with basically nothing.
Yes.
This is an article of I don't know how many hundreds of words.
Here's the conclusion that they actually drew. Fewer people vote in primaries than vote in general elections.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that they spent all their time and probably some money, taxpayer money at some point somewhere, to nail this down.
Yeah. Here's basically what they said. More white people show up to vote in primaries than minorities.
Right. And so their whole push on this is because these voter ID laws, states can alter the electorate and shift outcomes toward those on the right. But the point is their data really isn't showing that the changes are significantly greater, because then you go back up to their little graph now that you're more well informed, and you see that the difference between the white and the non-whites in these, between the primary and the general elections for Latinos, doesn't change. It stays at 13.2, which means that in most states with voter ID laws, that there are just fewer Latinos who decide that they want to vote, whether they're legal or not.
Yes.
Legal.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't matter. For Asians, it's becoming painfully obvious that probably many of them just don't bother with primaries. It goes from 18.8 to 11.5 in a general election. Well, Chuck, think about this. Unless you're in a community like the little Chinatowns, et cetera, or in majority Asian American, I know, like if you go around the university district at Ohio State, you're going to find a whole lot more Asians there than you will going, say, to Linden.
Right.
So if you're looking at voter turnout overall, it's clear that really the 11.5% percentage difference between Asian turnout in a general election versus white turnout in a general election, the one thing they haven't added in here is, what is your percentages of the gaps in these states in population ethnically? I mean, yeah, there may be a 12% difference in the turnout because, not because of voter ID laws, but just because that's just the general skew of the population. And of course, with black turnout in primary elections there's a gap of 11.6%, but it drops to 5.1% in general elections. Now, in non-strict voter ID states in a general election, the turnout rate is about 2.9% difference.
Well, okay. There's another thing in here. Off-year primaries can grossly skew those numbers.
Oh, absolutely. And we just said 2006 to 2014. So what do they have a lot of in there? They have two presidential election cycles, but then you've got 2006, 2010, 2014.
Okay. There's something.
Three off cycles. And then if they are picking every year, then what are they doing, Chuck? They're picking local turnout races.
That's right. Because if they're picking, for instance, some states, And some cities, in Ohio, for instance, odd year elections are local officials.
Yes.
City councils, mayors, a lot of stuff. And a lot of people just go, eh. You know, am I going to take a day, 3 hours off from work to go vote for Mayor Dimbulb? Probably not. I mean, only the people that really care go out and vote in some of these elections. Now, I always cared, and I always went out and voted, and I almost always tried to vote out incumbents. Just so you know that, folks. because they're becoming too entrenched. But that study, unless the numbers were very carefully vetted, is meaningless. And I think somebody just got together and stuck it in an Excel worksheet and pulled up an average standard deviation and, you know, that kind of stuff, and went with it from that. This proves it. Doesn't prove anything. Doesn't prove anything. It proves basically you're a master at manipulating numbers. And that's the problem. That's the problem we have right now, Barry. Journalism is no longer honest. It's advocacy.
But their whole deal, the reason why they put that whole thing out there was because they want to build the echo chamber around, yes, Sessions hates voting rights.
Sessions
act
hates
trying
voting
to suppress minorities, so that when the Trump administration and the attorney general pull out of this whole fight against Texas and their voter ID laws, it's because that there was this bigotry involved, and not because they're looking at numbers too and are like, this dog doesn't hunt.
Yeah.
Now And ultimately, the one little piece in that article that, you know, just kind of sticks under my fingernails and gives you that little achy pain, is that whole idea that minorities don't have as much access to photo IDs.
That's just nonsense.
Why in God's name would that have to be true? Because, you know, depending upon the state or the community, you know, wherever an individual intersects with government could be the opportunity for a photo ID, whether they drive a vehicle and, you know, actually have a driver's license, or if they don't. I know here in Ohio you can get a state-issued identification that's not a driver's license, but you can use it for establishing your identity in every other circumstance under the sun.
You know what, Barry? I know that you can walk into the Bureau of Motor Vehicles and walk out with a picture ID, and it used to cost $5.
Yeah, it's probably cost a little bit more now. But the point is, how many, you know, there are BMVs pretty much everywhere.
Yeah.
And even if that's not the case, let's say you're dealing with a disparate population. If you're going to, and then of course the argument would be raised, well, because they're, you know, poor, et cetera, they don't have the money, they don't have access. Well, if they're receiving any kind of government assistance, Chuck, regardless of whether that's welfare, Medicaid, you know, whatever it could be, couldn't that just be the instance to, you know, as a condition of qualifying for the program, is you have a photo ID taken?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't like that idea, but it doesn't raise to the level of, oh, woe is me, it's so bad, we can't do voter ID because many people just won't take the time and effort to go get one.
Look, everybody's got an
ID. But they want people to come out to vote who refuse to do a little bit of personal responsibility to get some kind of ID in order to prove who they are.
And they don't want to vote badly enough to go spend a couple bucks and get a photo ID. That's the bottom line. This is about what it's always been about, and that is to allow illegals to vote. That's the bottom line. And when people seriously sit there, there is no evidence of voter fraud. Oh, there's tons of evidence of voter fraud. California is rife with voter fraud. Chicago is rife with voter fraud. Look, Lyndon, we've talked about this before. Lyndon Johnson had a nickname. It was Landslide Lyndon. And, and he was called Landslide Lyndon because when he ran for Senate out of Texas, he was behind. And suddenly someone popped up with some little burg in Texas where everybody had come out and voted in alphabetical order, including some dead folk. They voted in exact alphabetical order, and they virtually all of them voted for Landslide Lyndon, and he won by some tiny amount, like in the votes in the hundreds. Well, it added up to these towns where people had voted in alphabetical order. What does that tell you? He stole the election. In the case of John F. Kennedy, by what margin did he win? He won by the margin of the state of Illinois. What was the last place always in Illinois to report presidential results? Always, 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 always. It's Chicago. Why? Because Chicago voting officials wanted to see how many votes were needed to make up a deficit that might exist from downstate voters to send the state over for the Democratic presidential candidate. The same thing happens in senatorial races in Illinois. Chicago has been stealing votes for decades. These are facts of life, folks. It's about vote theft. And I had friends who were telling me we need to go back to paper ballots. And I'm like, you don't think you can stuff a ballot box with paper ballots? It's been done. Ask Al Franken, Senator Al Franken out of Minnesota. Now, those weren't papers, I don't think. They were butterflies. Nonetheless, when he needed some votes to beat the Republican incumbent, what do you know? Two trunkfuls of ballots were suddenly found. Okay. I don't want to hear. I just really don't want to hear that there's no voter fraud. It's everywhere. And it always has been. Barry, look, dishonest elections have been around as long as the Republic. And it got really bad in the 1820s, when the party systems got up and running. That's essentially what the deal is. The party systems took over, and it led to corruption, not shockingly.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that being said, you got to send me that study so we can put it on when we post this stuff.
Yes, absolutely.
Because, yes, folks, that's right. You can go out to principledpolicy.com, www.principledpolicy.com. You can hear every show we've ever done. You can test us for our consistency. Are we saying the same things? Well, you've got years worth of programs that you can go back and listen to at principledpolicy.com. You will find that we are consistent. We do pretty much that. Now, have we ever changed our mind? Yeah, when more evidence comes in, Barry and I aren't afraid to say, okay.
Oops, we missed that one.
We missed that one. We made a mistake on there. We were wrong, and I'm not afraid to say that. There's no sin in being wrong.
My crystal ball is not made out of diamond. It's mainly made out of, that fake plastic that looks like diamond.
Yeah. When you're sincere in your research efforts, that's the thing. But when you see research like Barry just presented there, that's not a sincere effort. That's a propaganda effort. One thing I learned as a scientist, if you go in with a result that you want in mind into a set of experiments, you're going to find the result that you have in mind. That's not what science is. That's not what good research is. You go in to find out what the answer to a question is. Is this the case?
Yeah.
And when you manipulate numbers like that article did, it's not good science. It's not good journalism. It's not good anything. It's just propaganda. It is good propaganda. And that's about it. Well, you know what, Barry? I'm looking at the clock.
We're out of time.
We are out of time. You know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.